Just try that defence in court, see how far it gets you. If you try and save yourself by throwing me under the bus, I won't have any fucking problem telling the pigs you were in this thing all the way. So if that bit of paper turns up somewhere I don't want it to go, I haven't got it. I don't know where it is. You've been fucking warned. Give me your front door key. What? Why? Because I'm going over to that shithole you call a flat right now, and I'm searching it with Sam. You're not going over there without me. Why not? Got another Indian waiter sleeping off his hangover there, have you? I never... I don't give a shit, said Jimmy. Screw whoever you like. Give me your key. Give it me. More footsteps. A tinkling of keys. The sound of Jimmy walking away, and then a cascade of sobs that continued until Robin pressed pause. She cried until the shop owner came back, said Robin, which was just before I did, and she hardly spoke this afternoon. I tried to walk back to the tube with her, but she shook me off. Hopefully she'll be in a more talkative mood tomorrow. So, did you and Jimmy search her flat? Strike asked Barclay. Aye, books, drawers, under her mattress, nothing. What exactly did he say you were looking for? Bit of paper with handwriting and Billy's name on. He says, I had it in me wallet and it's gone. Claims it's something to do with a drugs deal. He thinks I'm some Ned who'll believe anything. Strike put down his pen, swallowed a large mouthful of noodles and said, Well, I don't know about you two, but what jumps out at me is it proves we had access. I think I might know a bit more about that, said Robin, who had so far successfully concealed her excitement about what she was about to reveal. I found out today that Flick can speak a bit of Polish, and we know she stole cash from her previous place of work. What if... I do that cleaning, said Strike suddenly. That's what she said to Jimmy on the march, when I was following them. I do that cleaning and it's disgusting. Bloody hell. You think she was... Chisel's Polish cleaner, said Robin, determined not to be robbed of her moment of triumph. Yes, I do. Barclay was continuing to shovel pork balls into his mouth, though his eyes were suitably surprised. If that's true, it changes bloody everything, said Strike. She'd have had access, been able to snoop around, take stuff into the house. How'd she find out he wanted a cleaner? Asked Barclay. Must have seen the card he put in a newsagent's window. They live miles apart. She's in Hackney. Maybe Jimmy spotted it, snooping around Ebury Street, trying to collect his blackmail money, suggested Robin. But Strike was frowning. But that's back to front. If she found out about the blackmailable offence when she was a cleaner, her employment must have predated Jimmy trying to collect money. All right, maybe Jimmy didn't tip her off. Maybe they found out he wanted a cleaner while they were trying to dig dirt on him in general. So they could run an expose on the Real Socialist Party website, suggested Barclay. That'll reach a good 4 or 5 people. Strike snorted in amusement. Main point is, he said, this piece of paper's got Jimmy very worried. Barclay speared his last pork ball and stuck it in his mouth.
Flick's taking it, he said thickly. I guarantee it.
Why are you so sure? Asked Robin.
She wants something over him, said Barclay, getting up to take his empty plate over to the sink. Only reason he's keeping her around is because she knows too much. He told me the other day he'd be happy to get short of her if he could. I asked why he couldn't have just dump her. He didn't answer.
Maybe she's destroyed it if it's so incriminating, suggested Robin.
I don't think so, said Strike. She's a lawyer's daughter. She's not going to destroy evidence. Something like that paper could be valuable. If the shit hits the fan and she decides she's going to cooperate with the police.
Barclay returned to the sofa and picked up his beer. How's Billy? Robin asked him, getting started at last on her own cooling meal.
Poor wee bastard, said Barclay. Skin and bone. The traffic cops caught him when he jumped a tube barrier. He tried to batter them, ended up being sectioned. The doctor says he's got delusions of persecution. At first, he thought he was being chased by the government and the medical staff were all part of some giant conspiracy, but now he's back on his medication. He's a wee bit more rational. Jimmy wanted to take him home there and then, but the docs were nae gonna let that happen. "What's really pissing Jimmy off," said Barclay, pausing to finish his can of Tennent's, "is Billy still obsessed with Strike. Keeps asking for him. The doctors think it's part of his delusion that he's latched on to the famous detective as part of his fantasy, like. The only person he can really trust. Couldn't tell them he and Strike have met. Not with Jimmy standing there telling him it's all a load of pish. The medics don't want anyone near him except family. And they're no keen on Jimmy anymore, neither. Not after he tried to persuade Billy he's well enough to go home." Barclay crushed his beer can in his hand and checked his watch. "Gotta go, Strike."
"Yeah, all right," said Strike. "Thanks for staying. Thought it would be good to have a joint debrief."
"Nae bother." With a wave to Robin, Barclay departed. Strike bent to pick up his own beer off the floor and winced. "You all right?" asked Robin, who was helping herself to more prawn crackers.
"Fine," he said, straightening up again. "I did a lot of walking again today, and I could have done without the fight yesterday."
"Fight? What fight?" asked Robin.
"Amir Malik."
"What?"
"Don't worry, I didn't hurt him. Much."
"You didn't tell me the argument got physical."
"I wanted to do it in person so I can enjoy you looking at me like I'm a complete bastard," said Strike. "How about a bit of sympathy for your one-legged partner?"
"You're an ex-boxer," said Robin, "and he probably weighs about 9 stone soaking wet."
"He came at me with a lamp."
"Amir did?" She couldn't imagine the reserved, meticulous man she had known in the House of Commons using physical violence against anyone.
"Yeah, I was pushing him about Chisel's man of your habits comment, and he snapped. If it makes you feel any better, I don't feel good about it," said Strike. "Hang on a minute. Need a pee."
He pulled himself awkwardly out of the chair and departed for the bathroom on the landing. As she heard the door close, Strike's mobile, which was charging on top of the filing cabinet beside Robin's desk, rang. She got up to check it, and saw through the cracked and sellotaped screen the name Lorelei. Wondering whether to answer it, Robin hesitated too long, and the call went to voicemail. Just as she was about to sit down again, a small ping declared that a text arrived. "If you want a hot meal in a shag with no human emotions involved, there are restaurants and brothels." Robin heard the bang of the bathroom door outside and stumbled hastily back to her chair. Strike limped back inside the room, lowered himself into his chair, and picked up his noodles. "Your phone just rang," said Robin.
"I didn't pick up." "Chuck it over," said Strike.
She did so. He read the text with no change of expression, muted the phone, and put it in his pocket.
"What were we saying?"
"That you didn't feel good about the fight."
"I feel fine about the fight," Strike corrected her. "If I hadn't defended myself, I'd have a face full of stitches."
He pronged a forkful of noodles.
"The bit I don't feel great about is when I told him I know he's been ostracized by his family, barring one sister who's still talking to him. It's all on Facebook. It was when I mentioned his family dropping him that I nearly got my head taken off with a table lamp."
"Maybe they're upset because they think he's with Della," suggested Robin, as Strike chewed his noodles. He shrugged and made an expression indicative of maybe, swallowed and said,
"Has it occurred to you that Amir is literally the only person connected with this case who's got a motive? Chisel threatened him, presumably with exposure. A man of your habits. Lachesis knew when everyone's time was up."
"What happened to forget about motive, concentrate on means?"
"Yeah, yeah," said Strike wearily.
He set aside his plate, from which he had eaten nearly all the noodles, took out his cigarettes and lighter, and sat up a little straighter.
Okay. Let's focus on means. Who had access to the house, to antidepressants and helium? Who knew Jasper Chisel's habits well enough to be sure he'd drink his orange juice that morning? Who had a key, or who would he have trusted enough to let in the early hours of the morning? Members of his family. Right, said Strike, as his lighter flared. But we know Kinvara, Fizzy, Izzy and Torquil can't have done it, which leaves us with Raphael and his story of being ordered down to Woolstone that morning. You really think he could have killed his father, then driven coolly down to Woolston to wait with Kinvara until the police arrived? Forget psychology or probability. We're considering opportunity, said Strike, blowing out a long jet of smoke. Nothing I've heard so far precludes Raphael being at Ebury Street at 6 in the morning. I know what you're going to say, he forestalled her, but it wouldn't be the first time a phone call had been faked by a killer. He could have called his own mobile with Chisel's to make it seem as though his father had ordered him down to Woolston. Which means that either Chisel didn't have a passcode on his mobile, or that Raphael knew it. Good point. That needs checking. Clicking out the nib of his pen, Strike made a note on his pad. As he did, he wondered whether Robin's husband, who had previously deleted her call history without her knowledge, knew her current passcode. These small matters of trust were often powerful indicators of the strength of a relationship. There's another logistical problem if Raphael was the killer, Robin said. He didn't have a key, and if his father let him in, it would mean Chisel was awake and conscious while Raphael pounded up antidepressants in the kitchen. Another good point, said Strike. But the pounding up of the pills has to be explained away with all of our suspects. Take Flick. If she was posing as the cleaner, she probably knew the house in Ebury Street better than most of the family. Loads of opportunities to poke around, and she had a restricted key for a while. They're hard to get copied, but let's say she managed it, so she could still let herself in and out of the house whenever she fancied. She creeps in the early hours to doctor the orange juice, but crushing pills in a pestle and mortar is a noisy job. Unless, said Robin, she brought the pills already crushed up, in a bag or something, and dusted them around the pestle and mortar to make it look as though Chisel had done it. Okay, but we still need to explain why there were no traces of amitriptyline in the empty orange juice carton in the bin. Raphael could plausibly have handed his father a glass of juice, except that Chisel's prints were the only ones on there. But would Chisel not find it odd to come downstairs in the morning to a pre-poured glass of juice? Would you drink a glass of something you hadn't poured, and which appeared mysteriously in what you thought was an empty house? Down in Denmark Street, a group of young women's voices rose over the constant swish and rumble of traffic, singing Rihanna's Where Have You Been? Where have you been? All my life, all my life. Maybe it was suicide, said Robin. That attitude won't get the bills paid, said Strike, tapping his cigarette ash onto his plate. Come on, people who had the means to get into Ebury Street that day. Raphael. Flick. And Jimmy, said Robin. Everything that applies to Flick applies to him, because she would have been able to give him all the information she had about Chisel's habits in his house, and given him her copied key. Correct. So those are three people we know could have got in that morning, said Strike. But this took much more than simply being able to get in through the door. The killer also had to know which antidepressants Kinvara was taking, and arrange for the helium canister and rubber tubing to be there, which suggests close contact with the Chisels, access to the house to get the stuff inside, or insider knowledge of the fact that the helium and tubing were already in there. As far as we know, Raphael hadn't been in Ebury Street lately, and wasn't on terms with Kinvara to know what pills she was taking, though I suppose his father might have mentioned it to him, said Robin. Judged on opportunity alone, the Wins and Amir seemed to be ruled out, so assuming she was the cleaner, Jimmy and Flick go to the top of our suspect list. Strike heaved a sigh and closed his eyes.
"Bollocks do it," he muttered, as he passed a hand across his face. "I keep circling back to motive."
Opening his eyes again, he stubbed out his cigarette on his dinner plate and immediately lit another one. "I'm not surprised MI5 are interested, because there's no obvious gain here. Oliver was right. Blackmailers don't generally kill their victims, it's the other way around. Hatred's a picturesque idea, but a hot-blooded hate-killing is a hammer or a lamp to the head, not a meticulously planned fake suicide. If it was murder, it was more like a clinical execution, planned in every detail. Why? What did the killer get out of it? Which also makes me wonder, why then? Why did Chisel die then? It was surely in Jimmy and Flick's best interests for Chisel to stay alive until they could produce evidence that forced him to come across with the money they wanted. Same with Raphael. He'd been written out of the will, but his relationship with his father was showing some signs of improvement. It was in his interest for his father to stay alive. But Chisel had covertly threatened Amir with exposure of something unspecified, but probably sexual, given the Catullus quotation. And he'd recently come into possession of information about the Wynne's dodgy charity. We shouldn't forget that Geraint Wynne wasn't really a blackmailer. He didn't want money. He wanted Chisel's resignation and disgrace. Is it beyond the realms of possibility that Wynne or Malik took a different kind of revenge when they realized the first plan had failed?
Strike dragged heavily on his cigarette and said, "We're missing something, Robin. The thing that ties all this together."
"Maybe it doesn't tie together," said Robin. "That's life, isn't it? We've got a group of people who all had their own personal tribulations and secrets. Some of them had reason not to like Chisel, to resent him, but that doesn't mean it all joins up neatly. Some of it must be irrelevant."
"There's still something we don't know."
"There's a lot we don't know. Something big. Something fundamental. I can smell it. It keeps almost showing itself. Why did Chisel say he might have more work for us after he'd scuppered Wynne and Knight?"
"I don't know," said Robin. "One by one, they tripped themselves up," Strike quoted.
"Who'd tripped themselves up?"
"Geraint Wynne. I'd just told him about the missing money from the charity."
"Chisel had been on the phone trying to find a money clip, you said. A money clip that belonged to Freddy."
"That's right," said Robin.
"Freddy," repeated Strike, scratching his chin. And for a moment, he was back in the communal TV room of a German military hospital, with the television muted in the corner and copies of the Army Times lying on a low table. The young lieutenant who had witnessed Freddy Chisel's death had been sitting there alone when Strike found him, wheelchair-bound, a Taliban bullet still lodged in his spine.
"The convoy stopped. Major Chisel told me to get out, see what was going on. I told him I could see movement up on the ridge. He told me to fucking well do as I was told. I hadn't gone more than a couple of feet when I got the bullet in the back. The last thing I remember was him yelling out of the lorry at me. Then the sniper took the top of his head off."
The lieutenant had asked Strike for a cigarette. He wasn't supposed to be smoking, but Strike had given him the half-pack he had on him.
"Chisel was a cunt," said the young man in the wheelchair.
In Strike's imagination, he saw tall, blonde Freddy swaggering up a country lane, slumming it with Jimmy Knight and his mates. He saw Freddy in fencing garb out on the piste, watched by the indistinct figure of Rhiannon Wynne, who was perhaps already entertaining suicidal thoughts. Disliked by his soldiers, revered by his father, could Freddy be the thing that Strike sought, the element that tied everything together, that connected two blackmailers and the story of a strangled child? But the notion seemed to dissolve as he examined it, and the diverse strands of the investigation fell apart once more, stubbornly unconnected.
"I want to know what the photographs from the Foreign Office show,"
said Strike aloud, his eyes on the purpling sky beyond the office window. I want to know who hacked the Uffington White Horse under the back of Amir Malik's bathroom door. And I want to know why there was a cross in the ground on the exact spot Billy said a kid was buried. Well, said Robin, standing up, and beginning to clear away the debris of their Chinese takeaway. Nobody ever said you weren't ambitious.
Leave that, I'll do it. You need to get home.
I don't want to go home. It won't take long. What are you up to tomorrow?
Got an afternoon appointment with Chisel's art dealer friend, Drummond.
Having rinsed off the plates and cutlery, Robin took her handbag down from the peg where she'd hung it, then turned back. Strike tended to rebuff expressions of concern, but she had to say it. No offence, but you look terrible. Maybe rest your leg before you have to go out again. See you soon.
She left before Strike could answer.
He sat lost in thought until, finally, he knew he must begin the painful journey back upstairs to his attic flat. Having heaved himself upright again, he closed the windows, turned off the lights, and locked up the office. As he placed his false foot on the bottom stair to the floor above, his phone rang again. He knew, without checking, that it was Lorelei. She wasn't about to let him go without at least attempting to hurt him as badly as he had hurt her. Slowly, carefully, keeping his weight off his prosthesis as much as was practical, Strike climbed the stairs to bed. Chapter 49 Rosmers of Rosmersholm, clergymen, soldiers, men who have filled high places in the state, men of scrupulous honour, every one of them. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Lorelei didn't give up. She wanted to see Strike face to face, wanted to know why she had given nearly a year of her life, as she saw it, to an emotional vampire. "You owe me a meeting," she said, when he finally picked up the phone at lunchtime next day. "I want to see you. You owe me that."
"And what will that achieve?" he asked her. "I read your email. You've made your feelings clear. I told you from the start what I wanted and what I didn't want.
Don't give me that 'I never pretended I wanted anything serious' line. Who did you call when you couldn't walk? You were happy enough for me to act like your wife when you were—"
"So let's both agree I'm a bastard," he said,
sitting in his combined kitchen sitting room with his amputated leg stretched out on a chair in front of him. He was wearing only boxer shorts, but would soon need to get his prosthesis on and dress smartly enough to blend in at Henry Drummond's art gallery.
"Let's wish each other well and—"
"No," she said. "You don't get out of it that easily. I was happy. I was doing fine. I never wanted to make you miserable. I like you."
"You like me?" she repeated shrilly. "A year together and you like me?" "What do you want?" he said, losing his temper at last. "Me to limp up the fucking aisle, not feeling what I should feel, not wanting it, wishing I was out of it? You're making me say what I don't want to say. I didn't want to hurt anyone."
"But you did. You did hurt me. And now you want to walk away as though nothing happened.
Whereas you want a public scene in a restaurant."
"I want," she said, crying now, "not to feel as though I could have been anyone. I want a memory of the end that doesn't make me feel disposable and cheap."
"I never saw you that way. I don't see you like that now," he said, eyes closed, wishing he had never crossed the room at Wardle's party. "Truth is, you're too—"
"Don't tell me I'm too good for you," she said. "Leave us both with some dignity." She hung up. Strike's dominant emotion was relief. No investigation had ever brought Strike so reliably back to the same small patch of London. The taxi disgorged him onto the gently sloping pavement of St. James's Street a few hours later, with the red brick St. James's Palace ahead and Pratt's on Park Place to his right. After paying off the driver, he headed for Drummond's Gallery, which lay between a wine dealer's and a hat shop on the left-hand side of the street. Although he had managed to put his prosthesis on, Strike was walking with the aid of a collapsible walking stick that Robin had bought him during another period when his leg had become almost too painful to bear his weight. Even if it had marked the end of a relationship he wanted to escape, the call with Lorelei had left its mark. He knew in his heart that he was, in the spirit if not in the letter, guilty of some of the charges she had laid against him. While he had told Lorelei at the outset that he sought neither commitment nor permanence, he had known perfectly well that she had understood him to mean right now rather than never, and he had not corrected that impression because he wanted a distraction and a defence against the feelings that had dogged him after Robin's wedding. However, the ability to section off his emotions, of which Charlotte had always complained, and to which Lorelei had dedicated a lengthy paragraph of the email dissecting his personality, had never failed him yet. Arriving 2 minutes early for his appointment with Henry Drummond, he transferred his attention with ease to the questions he intended to put to the late Jasper Chisel's old friend. Pausing beside the black marble exterior of the gallery, he saw himself reflected in the window and straightened his tie. He was wearing his best Italian suit. Behind his reflection, tastefully illuminated, a single painting in an ornate golden frame stood on an easel behind the spotless glass. It featured a pair of what, to Strike, looked like unrealistic horses with giraffe-like necks and staring eyes, ridden by 18th-century jockeys. The gallery beyond the heavy door was cool and silent, with a floor of highly polished white marble. Strike walked carefully with his stick among the sporting and wildlife paintings, which were illuminated discreetly around the white walls, all of them in heavy gilded frames, until a well-groomed young blonde in a tight black dress emerged from a side door. "Oh, good afternoon," she said, without asking his name, and walked away towards the back of the gallery, her stilettos making a metallic click on the tiles. "Henry, Mr. Strike's here." A concealed door opened, and Drummond emerged. A curious-looking man, whose ascetic features of pinched nose and black brows were enclosed by rolls of fat around chin and neck, as though a Puritan had been engulfed by the body of a jolly squire. With his mutton-chop whiskers and dark grey suit and waistcoat, he had a timeless, irrefutably upper-class appearance. "How do you do?" he said, offering a warm, dry hand. "Come into the office." "Henry, Mrs. Ross just called," said the blonde, as Strike walked into the small room beyond the discreet door, which was book-lined, mahogany-shelved, and very tidy. "She'd like to see the Munnings before we close. I've told her it's reserved, but she'd still like—" "Let me know when she arrives," said Drummond. "And could we have some tea, Lucinda? Or coffee?" he inquired of Strike. "Tea would be great, thank you." "Do sit down," said Drummond, and Strike did so, grateful for a large and sturdy leather chair. The antique desk between them was bare but for a tray of engraved writing paper, a fountain pen, and an ivory and silver letter opener. "So," said Henry Drummond heavily, "you're looking into this appalling business for the family." "That's right. Do you mind if I take notes?" "Carry on." Strike took out his notebook and pen. Drummond swiveled gently from side to side in his rotating chair. "Terrible shock," he said softly. "Of course, one thought immediately of foreign interference. Government minister, eyes of the world on London with the Olympics and so forth." "You didn't think he could have committed suicide?" asked Strike. Drummond sighed heavily. "I knew him for 45 years. His life had not been devoid of vicissitudes. To have come through everything, the divorce from Patricia, Freddie's death, resignation from the government, Raphael's ghastly car accident, to end it now, when he was Minister for Culture, when everything seemed back on track." "Because the Conservative Party was his life's blood, you know," said Drummond. "Oh, yes. He'd bleed blue. Hated being out. Delighted to get back in again. Rise to minister. We joked of him becoming PM in our younger days, of course. but that dream was gone. Jasper always said, Tory faithful like bastards or buffoons, and that he was neither one nor the other. So you'd say he was in generally good spirits around the time he died. No, I wouldn't say that. There were stresses, worries, but suicidal? Definitely not. When was the last time you saw him?
The last time we met face to face was here, at the gallery, said Drummond.
I can tell you exactly what date it was. Friday the 22nd of June. This, Strike knew, was the day that he had met Chisel for the first time. He remembered the minister walking away towards Drummond's gallery after their lunch at Pratt's.
And how did he seem to you that day?
Extremely angry, said Drummond. But that was inevitable, given what he walked in on here. Drummond picked up the letter opener and turned it delicately in his thick fingers. His son, Raphael, had just been caught for the second time. Drummond balked for a second. In flagrante, he said, with the other young person I employed at that time, in the bathroom behind me. He indicated a discreet black door. I had already caught them in there a month prior to that. I hadn't told Jasper the first time, because I felt he had quite enough on his plate.
In what way?
Drummond fingered the ornate ivory, cleared his throat and said, Jasper's marriage Kinvara is a handful, difficult woman. She was badgering Jasper to put one of her mares in foal to Totilus at the time. When Strike looked blank, Drummond elucidated. A top dressage stallion, nigh on 10,000 for seamen.
Christ, said Strike.
Well, quite, said Drummond. And when Kinvara doesn't get what she wants, one doesn't know whether it's temperament or something deeper, actual mental instability. Anyway, Jasper had a very difficult time with her. Then he'd been through the ghastly business of Raphael's, accident. That poor young mother killed, the press, and so on and so forth. His son in jail. As a friend, I didn't want to add to his troubles. I told Raphael the first time it happened that I wouldn't inform Jasper, but I also said he was on a final warning, and if he stepped out of line again, he would be out on his ear, old friend of his father's or not. I had Francesca to consider, too. She's my goddaughter, 18 years old and completely smitten with him. I didn't want to have to tell her parents. So, when I walked in and heard them, I really had no choice. I thought I was safe to leave Raphael in charge for an hour because Francesca wasn't at work that day. But of course she'd sneaked in specially to see him on her day off. Jasper arrived to find me pounding on the door. There was no way to hide what was going on. Raphael was trying to block my entrance to the bathroom here while Francesca climbed out of the window. She couldn't face me. I rang her parents, told them everything. She never came back. Raphael Chisel, said Drummond heavily, is a bad lot. Freddy, the son who died, my godchild too, incidentally, was worth a million of... Well, well, he said, turning the penknife over and over in his fingers. One shouldn't say it, I know. The office door opened, and the young blonde in the black dress entered with a tea tray. Strike compared it mentally to the tea he had in the office as she set down two silver pots, one containing hot water, bone china cups and saucers, and a sugar bowl complete with tongs. Mrs. Ross has just arrived, Henry. Tell her I'm tied up for the next 20 minutes or so. Ask her to wait if she's got time.
So I take it, said Strike when Lucinda had left, that there wasn't much time for conversation that day.
Well, no, said Drummond unhappily. Jasper had come to see Raphael at work, believing that all was going splendidly, and to arrive in the middle of that scene, totally on my side, obviously, once he grasped what was going on. He was the one who actually shoved the boy out of the way to get the bathroom door open. Then he turned a nasty colour. He had a heart problem, you know. It had been grumbling on for years. Sat down on the toilet rather suddenly.
I was very worried, but he wouldn't let me call Kinvara. Raphael had the decency to be ashamed of himself then. Tried to help his father. Jasper told him to get out of it. Made me close the door, leave him in there. Now sounding gruff, Drummond broke off and poured himself on strike tea. He was evidently in some distress. As he added three lumps to his own cup, the teaspoon rattled against the cup. Apologize. Last time I ever saw Jasper, you see. He came out of the bathroom, ghastly colour. Still shook my hand, apologized, said he'd let his oldest friend... Let me down. Drummond coughed again, swallowed, and continued with what seemed an effort. None of it was Jasper's fault. Raphael learned such morals as he's got from the mother, and she's best described as a high-class... Well, well. Meeting Ornella was really the start of all Jasper's problems. If he'd only stayed with Patricia. Anyway, I never saw Jasper again. I had some difficulty bringing myself to shake Raphael's hand at the funeral, if you want the truth. Drummond took a sip of tea, and Strike tried his own. It was far too weak. All sounds very unpleasant, the detective said. You may well say so, sighed Drummond. You'll appreciate that I have to ask about some sensitive matters. Of course, said Drummond. You've spoken to Izzy. Did she tell you that Jasper Chisel was being blackmailed? She mentioned it, said Drummond, with a glance to check that the door was shut. He hadn't breathed a word to me. Izzy said it was one of the nights. One remembers a family in the grounds. The father was an odd job man, yes? As for the Wynns, well, no. I don't think there was much liking between them and Jasper. Strange couple. The Wynn's daughter, Rhiannon, was a fencer, said Strike. She was on the junior British fencing team with Freddie Chisel. Oh, yes, Freddie was awfully good, said Drummond. Rhiannon was a guest at Freddie's 18th birthday party, but she was a couple of years younger. She was only 16 when she killed herself. How ghastly, said Drummond. You don't know anything about that. How should I? Said Drummond, a fine crease between his dark eyes. You weren't at the 18th? I was, as a matter of fact. Godfather, you know. You can't remember Rhiannon. Goodness, you can't expect me to remember all the names. There were upwards of 100 young people there. Jasper had a marquee in the garden, and Patricia ran a treasure hunt. Really? Said Strike. His own 18th birthday party, in a run-down pub in Shoreditch, had not included a treasure hunt. Just in the grounds, you know. Freddie always liked a competition. A glass of champagne at every clue. It was rather jolly. Got things off with a swing. I was manning clue 3, down by what the children always used to call the dell. The hollow in the ground by the knight's cottage, asked Strike casually. It was full of nettles when I saw it. We didn't put the clue in the dell. We put it under Jack O'Kent's doormat. He couldn't be trusted to take care of the champagne because he had a drink problem. I sat on the edge of the dell in a deck chair and watched them hunt, and everyone who found the clue got a glass of champagne, and off they went. Soft drinks for the under-18s? Asked Strike. Faintly exasperated by this killjoy attitude, Drummond said, Nobody had to drink champagne. It was an 18th, a celebration. So Jasper Chisel never mentioned anything to you that he wouldn't want to get into the press, asked Strike, returning to the main point. Nothing whatsoever. When he asked me to find a way of countering his blackmailers, he told me that whatever he'd done happened 6 years ago. He implied to me that it wasn't illegal when he did it, but it is now. I've no idea what that could have been. Jasper was a very law-abiding type, you know. Whole family, pillars of the community, churchgoers. They've done masses for the local area. A litany of Chiswellian beneficence followed, which rolled on for a couple of minutes, and did not fool Strike in the slightest. Drummond was obfuscating, he was sure,
because Drummond knew exactly what Chisel had done. He became almost lyrical as he extolled the innate goodness of Jasper and of the entire family, excepting always the scapegrace Raphael. "And hand always in his pocket," Drummond concluded. "Minibus for the local brownies, repairs to the church roof, even after the family finances." "Well, well," he said again, in a little embarrassment. "The blackmailable offence," Strike began again, but Drummond interrupted. "There was no offence." He caught himself. "You just said it yourself. Jasper told you he had done nothing illegal. No law was broken." Deciding that it would do no good to push Drummond harder about the blackmail, Strike turned a page in his notebook and thought he saw the other relax. "You called Chisel on the morning he died," said Strike. "I did. Would that have been the first time you'd spoken since sacking Raphael?" "Actually, no. There had been a conversation a couple of weeks prior to that. My wife wanted to invite Jasper and Kinvara over for dinner. I called him at DCMS, breaking the ice, you know, after the Raphael business. It wasn't a long conversation, but amicable enough. He said they couldn't make the night suggested. He also told me... well, to be frank, he told me he wasn't sure how much longer he and Kinvara would be together, that the marriage was in trouble. He sounded tired, exhausted, unhappy. You had no more contact until the 13th. "We had no contact even then," Drummond reminded him. "I phoned Jasper, yes, but there was no answer. Izzy tells me..." He faltered. "She tells me that he was probably already dead." "It was early for a call," said Strike. "I had information I thought he should have."
"Of what kind?"
"It was personal." Strike waited. Drummond sipped his tea. "It related to the family finances, which, as I imagine you know, were very poor at the time Jasper died."
"Yes."
"He'd sold off land and remortgaged the London property, offloaded all the good paintings through me. He was right down to the dregs at the end, trying to sell me some of old Tinky's leavings. It was a little embarrassing, actually."
"How so?"
"I deal in old masters," said Drummond. "I do not buy paintings of spotted horses by unknown Australian folk artists. As a courtesy to Jasper, being an old friend, I had some of it valued with my usual man at Christie's. The only thing that had any monetary worth at all was a painting of a piebald mare and foal."
"I think I've seen that," said Strike.
"But it was worth peanuts," said Drummond.
"Peanuts? How much, as a guess?"
5,000 to 8,000 at a push," said Drummond dismissively.
"Quite a lot of peanuts to some people," said Strike.
"My dear fellow," said Henry Drummond, "that wouldn't have repaired a tenth of the roof at Chisel House."
"But he was considering selling it," asked Strike.
"Along with half a dozen others," said Drummond.
"I had the impression that Mrs. Chisel was particularly attached to that painting. I don't think his wife's wishes were of much importance to him by the end."
"Oh, dear," sighed Drummond. "This is all very difficult. I really don't wish to be responsible for telling the family something that I know will only cause hurt and anger. They're already suffering." He tapped his teeth with a nail. "I assure you," he said, "that the reason for my call cannot have any bearing on Jasper's death." Yet he seemed in two minds. "You must speak to Raphael," he said, clearly choosing his words with care. "Because I think, possibly, I don't like Raphael," he said, as though he had not already made that perfectly clear. "But I think, actually, he did an honourable thing on the morning his father died. At least I can't see what he personally had to gain by it. And I think he's keeping silent about it for the same reason as myself. Being in the family, he is better placed to decide what to do than I can be. Speak to Raphael." Strike had the impression that Henry Drummond would rather Raphael made himself unpopular with the family. There was a knock on the office door. Blonde Lucinda put her head inside.
"Mrs. Ross isn't feeling terribly well, Henry. She's going to go, but she'd like to say goodbye."
"Yes, all right," said Drummond, getting to his feet. "I don't think I can be of more use, I'm afraid, Mr. Strike." "I'm very grateful for you seeing me," said Strike, also rising, though with difficulty, and picking up his walking stick again. "Could I ask one last thing?"
"Certainly,"
said Drummond, pausing. "Do you understand anything by the phrase, 'he put the horse on them'?" Drummond appeared genuinely puzzled.
"Who put what horse where?"
"You don't know what that might mean."
"I've really no idea. Terribly sorry, but as you've heard, I've got a client waiting."
Strike had no alternative but to follow Drummond back into the gallery. In the middle of the otherwise deserted gallery stood Lucinda, who was fussing over a dark, heavily pregnant woman, sitting on a high chair, sipping water. As he recognized Charlotte, Strike knew that this second encounter could not be a coincidence. Chapter 50. "You have branded me once for all, branded me for life." Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm.
"Corm," she said weakly, gaping at him over the rim of her glass.
She was pale, but Strike, who would have put nothing past her to stage a situation that she could use to her advantage, including skipping food or applying white foundation, merely nodded.
"Oh, you know each other,"
said Drummond, surprised.
"I must go,"
mumbled Charlotte, getting to her feet while the concerned Lucinda hovered.
"I'm late. I'm meeting my sister."
"Are you sure you're well enough?"
asked Lucinda. Charlotte gave Strike a tremulous smile.
"Would you mind walking me up the road? It's only a block."
Drummond and Lucinda turned to Strike, clearly delighted to offload responsibility for this wealthy, well-connected woman onto his shoulders.
"I'm not sure I'm the best person for the job," said Strike, indicating his stick.
He felt Drummond and Lucinda's surprise.
"I'll give you plenty of warning if I think I'm actually going into labour," said Charlotte.
"Please." He could have said no. He might have said, "Why don't you get your sister to meet you here?" A refusal, as she knew well, would make him appear churlish in front of people he might need to talk to again.
"Fine," he said, keeping his voice just the right side of brusque.
"Thank you so much, Lucinda," said Charlotte, sliding down from the chair.
She was wearing a beige silk trench coat over a black T-shirt, maternity jeans, and sneakers. Everything she wore, even these casual things, was of fine quality. She had always favoured monochrome colours, stark or classic designs, against which her remarkable beauty was thrown into relief. Strike held open the door for her, reminded by her pallor of the occasion when Robin had turned white and clammy at Journey's End, after deftly steering a hire car out of what could have been a disastrous crash on black ice.
"Thank you," he said to Henry Drummond.
"My pleasure," said the art dealer formally.
"The restaurant's not far,"
Charlotte said, pointing up the slope as the gallery door swung shut. They walked side by side, passers-by perhaps assuming that he was responsible for her bulging stomach. He could smell what he knew was Shalimar on her skin. She had worn it ever since she was 19, and he had sometimes bought it for her. Once again, he remembered walking this way towards the argument with her father in an Italian restaurant so many years ago.
"You think I arranged this?"
Strike said nothing. He had no desire to become enmeshed in disagreement or reminiscence. They had walked for two blocks before he spoke.
"Where is this place?"
"Jermyn Street, Franco's."
The moment she said the name, he recognized it as the very same one in which they had met Charlotte's father all those years previously. The ensuing row had been short, but exceedingly vicious, for a vein of incontinent spite ran right through every member of Charlotte's aristocratic family. But then she and Strike had gone back to her flat, and made love with an intensity and urgency that he now wished he could expunge from his brain. The memory of her crying even as she climaxed, hot tears falling onto his face as she shouted with pleasure. "Ouch! Stop!" she said sharply. He turned. Cradling her belly with both hands, she backed into a doorway, frowning. "Sit down," he said, resenting even having to make suggestions to help her. "On the step, there."
"No," she said, taking deep breaths. "Just get me to Franco's and you can go."
They walked on.
The maître d'hôtel was all concern. It was clear that Charlotte was not well. "Is my sister here?" Charlotte asked.
"Not yet," said the maître d' anxiously, and like Henry Drummond and Lucinda, he looked to Strike to share responsibility for this alarming and unsought problem. Barely a minute later, Strike was sitting in Amelia's seat at the table for two beside the window, and the waiter was bringing a bottle of water, and Charlotte was still taking deep breaths, and the maître d' was putting bread down between them, saying uncertainly that Charlotte might feel better if she ate something, but also suggesting quietly to Strike that he could call an ambulance at any moment, if that seemed desirable. At last they were left alone. Still, Strike did not speak. He intended to leave the moment her colour improved or her sister arrived. All around them sat well-heeled diners, enjoying wine and pasta amid tasteful wood, leather and glass, with black and white prints on the geometric white and red wallpaper.
"You think I arranged this?" mumbled Charlotte again.
Strike said nothing. He was keeping lookout for Charlotte's sister, whom he had not seen for years, and who doubtless would be appalled to find them sitting together. Perhaps there would be another tight-lipped row, hidden from their fellow diners, in which fresh aspersions would be cast upon his personality, his background, and his motives in escorting his wealthy, pregnant, married ex-girlfriend to her dinner date. Charlotte took a breadstick and began to eat it, watching him.
"I really didn't know you were going to be there today, Corm."
He didn't believe it for a second. The meeting at Lancaster House had been chance. He had seen her shock when their eyes met, but this was far too much of a coincidence. If he hadn't known it to be impossible, he would even have supposed that she knew he had split up with his girlfriend that morning.
"You don't believe me?"
"It doesn't matter," he said, still scanning the street for Amelia.
"I got a real shock when Lucinda said you were there."
"Bollocks. She wouldn't have told you who was in the office. You already knew."
"This happens a lot lately," she persisted. "They call them Braxton Hicks contractions. I hate being pregnant."
He knew he had not disguised his immediate thought when she leaned towards him and said quietly,
"I know what you're thinking.
I didn't get rid of ours. I didn't."
"Don't start, Charlotte," he said,
with a sensation that the firm ground beneath his feet was starting to crack and shift.
I'm not doing this again," he said, a warning note in his voice. "We're not going back over dates from 2 years ago. I don't care. I took a test at my mother's. I said I don't care."
He wanted to leave, but she was, if anything, paler now, her lips trembling as she gazed at him with those horribly familiar, russet-flecked green eyes, now brimming with tears. The swollen belly still didn't seem part of her. He would not have been entirely surprised had she lifted her T-shirt to show a cushion.
"I wish they were yours."
"Fuck's sake, Charlotte.
If they were yours, I'd be happy about it."
"Don't give me that. You didn't want kids any more than I did."
Tears now tipped over onto her cheeks. She wiped them away, her fingers shaking more violently than ever. A man at the next table was trying to pretend that he wasn't watching. Always hyper-aware of the effect that she was having on those around her, Charlotte threw the eavesdropper a look that made him return hurriedly to his tortellini, then tore off a piece of bread and put it in her mouth, chewing while crying. Finally, she gulped water to help her swallow, then pointed at her belly and whispered, "I feel sorry for them. That's all I've got. Pity. I feel sorry for them because I'm their mother and Jago's their father. What a start in life. In the beginning, I tried to think up ways of dying without killing them."
"Don't be so fucking self-indulgent," Strike said roughly. "They're going to need you, aren't they?"
"I don't want to be needed. I never did. I want to be free."
"To kill yourself?"
"Yes. Or to try and make you love me again."
He leaned in towards her. "You're married. You're having children. We're finished. It's over."
She leaned in too, her tear-stained face the most beautiful he had ever seen. He could smell Shalimar on her skin.
"I'll always love you better than anyone in this world," she said,
stark white and stunning.
"You know that's the truth. I loved you better than anyone in my family. I'll love you better than my children. I'll love you on my deathbed. I think about you when Jago and I..."
"Keep this up and I'm leaving."
She leaned back in her seat again and stared at him as though he were an approaching train and she was tied to the tracks.
"You know it's true," she said hoarsely. "You know it is."
"Charlotte,
I know what you're going to say," she said, "that I'm a liar. I am a liar. But not on the big things, never on the big ones, Bluey.
Don't call me that."
"You didn't love me enough. Don't you fucking blame me," he said in spite of himself.
Nobody else did this to him. Nobody even came close. "The end. That was all you.
You wouldn't compromise."
"Oh, I compromised. I came to live with you like you wanted. You wouldn't take the job, Daddy." "I had a job. I had the agency."
"I was wrong about the agency. I know that now. You've done such incredible things. I read everything about you all the time. Jago found it all on my search history.
Should have covered your tracks, shouldn't you? You were a damn sight more careful with me when you were screwing him on the side."
"I wasn't sleeping with Jago while I was with you.
You got engaged to him 2 weeks after we finished.
It happened fast because I made it happen fast," she said fiercely. "You said I was lying about the baby, and I was hurt, furious. You and I would be married now if you hadn't." "Menus?"
said a waiter suddenly, materializing beside their table, handing one to each of them. Strike waved his away.
"I'm not staying."
"Take it for Amelia," Charlotte instructed him,
and he pulled the menu out of the waiter's hand and slapped it down on the table in front of him.
"We have a couple of specials today," said the waiter.
"Do we look like we want to hear specials?" Strike growled.
The waiter stood for a second, frozen in astonishment, then wound his way back through the crowded tables, his back view affronted.
"All this romantic bullshit," Strike said, leaning into Charlotte. "You wanted things I couldn't give you every single fucking time. You hated the poverty."
"I acted like a spoiled bitch," she said. "I know I did. Then I married Jago, and I got all those things I thought I deserved, and I want to fucking die."
"It goes beyond holidays and jewelry, Charlotte. You wanted to break me."
Her expression became rigid, as it so often had before the worst outbursts, the truly horrifying scenes.
"You wanted to stop me wanting anything that wasn't you. That'd be the proof I loved you. If I gave up the army, the agency, Dave Polworth, every bloody thing that made me who I am."
"I never, ever wanted to break you. That's a terrible thing to..."
"You wanted to smash me up because that's what you do. You have to break it because if you don't, it might fade away. You've got to be in control. If you kill it, you don't have to watch it die."
"Look me in the eye and tell me you've loved anyone since, like you loved me."
"No, I haven't," he said. "And thank fuck for that."
"We had incredible times together. You'll have to remind me what they were. That night on Benji's boat in Little France."
"Your 30th, Christmas in Cornwall, They were a whole lot of fucking fun.
Her hand felt